You are listening to Eon. AEON.net.au.
You are listening to the TER podcast, the Teachers Education Review.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Teachers Education Review, the Australian podcast for teachers that bridges the gap between research, policy and practice. This is episode number 207, released on Thursday the 13th of October, 2022. I'm Cameron Malcher. In this episode, Stephen Kolber explores one way to elevate your teaching with read-aloud assessments in Kolber's Corner. Tom Marnie questions the ideological underpinnings of the Productivity Commission's recent interim report into education. I speak with Dr. Phil Cummins and Adriano De Prato about their podcast Changemakers. And for our main feature, I speak with Stephanie Westcott about her recent PhD thesis into teaching in the post-truth era. This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and extend those respects to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people listening to this podcast. Welcome back, everyone. And it is the start of Term 3, a week or two in, depending on what sector you're in. Victorian schools went back a little over a week ago. New South Wales schools returned this week. And it is now into the final stretches of the year. HSC exams here in New South Wales started and was under the threat of a possible teachers' strike for quite a while. There has been a nearly year-long running dispute between the public sector union, the New South Wales Teachers Federation, and the government over salary and conditions. And on the same day that students were due to start their HSC, the government were taking their case to the Industrial Relations Commission, trying to get a forced decision on a new salaries agreement that the union claims represents a significant pay cut, as it is considerably below the current rate of inflation and certainly below the projected rate of inflation. It's been an interesting year-long campaign here in New South Wales because for the first time in a long time, it has been jointly supported by both the public sector and independent school sector unions, both of whom are experiencing significant shortages of teachers and difficulties staffing rural and remote areas. And both say that part of that is down to the government's action or inaction on the issues of recruiting and retaining teachers in the system. Anyhow, at the 11th hour, or at least maybe 3 or 4 days before, the strike was called off, but the HSC exams went ahead as scheduled, and teachers were instead engaged here in New South Wales in a day of action, more of a social media campaign to show general displeasure and support for the cause of teacher salaries. I'm recording this before I have yet to see exactly what the outcome of the Industrial Relations Commission's findings were, but one way or another, it's sure to be an interesting discussion or an interesting ongoing part of the campaign. Of course, here in New South Wales, we are due for a state election in March. Victoria, however, are due for a state election in November. So education and electoral promises are sure to be dominating those states' relative news cycles for the next few weeks and indeed the next few months here in New South Wales. That being said, we have got a big episode for you this fortnight. We're going to start off with our regular segments. Then I've got an interview with another pair of Australian educational podcasters. And then we have a feature interview which delves into some really interesting concepts in education, dealing with the notion of what is the post-truth era, how does it affect education, discourse, and policy, and what does it mean to have policy exist in a kind of hegemonic structure that doesn't allow itself to be questioned. So, without any further ado, let us get on to the first of our regular features. And Stephen Kolber is here to talk about one of the ways you can use technology to engage and elevate your assessment and marking processes. So here he is, Steve Kolber with Kolber's Corner.
Lovely people, and welcome to Kolber's Corner for another go around, another fortnight. Today, very simple. I had the good fortune to present a short little session, a webinar to teachers on the topic of how to streamline workflow. So basically, how digital technologies can help us teachers to do what we do, but a little bit quicker. And on one side, I found this very challenging because, you know, as my fellow podcast contributor Tom Mahoney tells us often, you know, the ideologies are important. And of course, the idea of working quickly, efficiently, and all those sort of things are very much a neoliberal concept. So, you know, whether it's neo-Fordism or some other version of sort of efficiency, like it conjures images of industrial sites, you've got whistles, you've got clocking cards, you've got, you know, improvements happening from, you know, if something can be done more effectively or more efficiently, you've got people being replaced with robots, you've got lots of checklists, you've got tick sheets, you've got people walking around with clipboards, making sure things are going effectively and efficiently, you've got people being compared to one another, who's stacking the most, who's, you know, bagging more quickly, all those kind of things. You've got questions of efficiency that, you know, of course, is something Tom speaks about often, that kind of that idea of, you know, consistency and efficiency, and whether or not that fits with education or not is sort of something that I think reflecting on, I've found difficult to sort of unravel. But with that out of the way, I think there's also a sense of sort of collectivism, a sense of unionism almost, like if we were to extend the metaphor, if we were actually working in a factory and, you know, someone said, oh, you know, I wear a back brace when I'm on, you know, the boxing section, lifting heavy boxes onto trucks, for example, and the back brace sort of supports me. And then that way, you know, 10 years down the line, I won't have back problems, I won't have back pain, I won't have back spasms. That in and of itself, that kind of thing, support from another worker, from another, in this case, another teacher, I think is incredibly valuable. But of course, it can't, you know, all of it contextually exists within the sort of neoliberal idea that we're perhaps not best suited for and perhaps not things we want to support. So there's complexities to it, but there's also, I think, great power in sharing that kind of streamlining the things that make our work more bearable, more achievable, and those kind of things. So it's in that light that I'm going to present, you know, a series of sort of things that, in my opinion, make things a lot easier and a lot quicker. So this one's very, very simple. I'm an English teacher, so I, in an average year, would be reading hundreds of thousands of words produced and written by students. The obvious way to make that different, you know, is to sort of think, well, we're going to use a whole range of tools, we're going to be digitally minded, we're going to do things in a thousand different ways. They're going to be making podcasts and videos and, you know, collages and, you know, atmospheric soundscapes and all those sort of things. And as nice as that sounds, there is sort of, you know, of course, certain requirements on us that we get our students writing and speaking and reading, in fact, as well. So kind of, you know, there's always that push towards those sort of things as well. And so for me, something I've found incredibly useful is, because everything is done via rubric, getting Word, PDF, browsers, whatever it is, get it to read out loud students' work. So anytime you have a large chunk of student work, treat it as an audiobook, get it to be read aloud, crank that speed up, you know, to 2 if you have to, 3 if you're in a rush. You know, if And this happens quite often because I'm the sort of teacher who's, you know, of course, encouraging literacy, writing of all kinds. So if any of my students ever says, hey, I've written a story, I've written a novel, you know, I'm working on a novella, I'm writing something beyond and or in addition to school, then of course I'm going to say, I'd love to read it, send me a copy. But then, of course, I don't necessarily have the amount of time I would like to sit down and pore over it as I would a fine novel, especially if it's been written by a young person who perhaps isn't necessarily at the same level as the sort of novelists I would be reading for fun. So in that case, I'm going to be reading it aloud. If it's an assignment, of course, I'll have the rubric open on another screen or, you know, on the screen. And in the background, the app can be reading out loud the text to me. So I can be writing comments as things occur, as they happen, and marking the rubric up or down as the text is being read to me by the device. So keeping in mind, of course, this might be a very English teacher thing to talk about. If you're doing short answer tests or multiple choice tests, perhaps it's not as efficient or necessary. But if there's ever science report, an extended piece of writing is something I highly recommend. Have the rubric in front of you, have whatever the assessment requirements of the task are right in front of you, and you can have it listening, playing to you as you mark those things. So rather than double handling, you know, reading first, then marking, you can be doing both simultaneously. Obviously, it requires that you understand the rubric enough and that you can, you know, not split your focus, but listen for key things that you're listening out for the rubric. But for me, it's a game changer. It's very rare that you'd find me sitting down with a printed copy of a text without having it read aloud to me, just for speed of use. Less time marking, more time teaching. That would be the goal. Until next time, keep reading, keep writing, keep learning.
And that was Steve Kolber with Kolber's Corner. You can find him on Twitter at Stephen_Kolber or look for the link to his profile in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. On to our next regular feature, and Tom Marnie is back with Ideology in Education to look at a major report that was published in recent weeks from the Federal Productivity Commission. And this was part of their interim report, which included a significant a section discussing potential productivity increases in the education sector. So here now is Tom Marnie with Ideology in Education.
Welcome to Ideology in Education. In this segment, like I usually do, I spend a bit of time looking at the ways that ideologies impact on educational policy discourse and practice. And what better time to start thinking about ideologies and looking at the way that they impact on education than when a government report is released? And so, if you're not aware, and some of you might be aware, that the Australian Government Productivity Commission recently released their interim report for their 5-year productivity inquiry. Now, as part of that, they had a specific section devoted to education, which was called From Learning to Growth. And in this episode, I want to just discuss some of the ideologies that I see coming through in the media release that's on the essentially the cover page for the education section of the interim report. Now, the interim report itself is huge. And so I've downloaded the document and I started working through it. But man, it is big. So this is not going to be a full-blown investigation of that, though I hope to eventually get to a point where I can have maybe a more nuanced understanding of the report itself and provide maybe some clearer perspectives on that. But today, we're just going to focus on the media release, which in many ways actually gives us a pretty clear indication of the kinds of ideologies that are grounding this report. So there are two particular ideologies that I do want to make mention of at the start, and we'll see how they come together in this report. The first is neoliberalism, which sees markets and competition and deregulation as really important drivers for change, and in this case for educational growth. And the second one is social efficiency, which has an obsession with measurement to meet the needs of a client. And so we'll see how that comes into play in this particular release. So the heading itself and the first sentence gives us probably a pretty clear indication of those two ideologies. The heading says getting more value from education, and the first sentence says high quality school and tertiary education systems are vital for a productive workforce. Now, this whole thing about getting more value from education is something that comes up a lot. It's seeing education as something that we need to get value for money. It's like a service that we pay for. We pay for this and we should get some sort of response, so or some sort of adequate reimbursement for our time and investment, right? Now, this comes up quite a bit, and this is kind of intertwined with this neoliberal ideology, which values competition. We can see in this media release some mentions to competition as needing to be increased. And I'm quoting here, we need more innovation, competition, and choice in our tertiary education sector. Now, I find that a really interesting statement, considering that from the readings that I've done and the people that I've communicated with in the university sector, Australia's universities are one of the most, it seems, from my perspective and what I've seen, one of the most neoliberalized institutions in our country. Now, when I talk about institutions, I mean like educational institutions. Our schools are actually not as neoliberalized in many ways, which I find really interesting. There is also a mention that schools need to shift their focus to skills that are demanded by Australian businesses. Now, this, once again, is social efficiency. The role of education is simply to meet the needs of Australian businesses, which is debatable. It's kind of interesting looking through this report. A couple of sentences stuck out to me a little bit. And one was, schools should focus on gathering and spreading evidence to improve the quality of teaching. But then there's also this need to increase competition between providers. And increasing choice and increasing competition, but then trying to create a collaborative environment, I'm not necessarily sure how those can actually coexist well. But anyway, let's keep going. The last thing I do want to mention on this, the last thing I can see here is, the quote is, that is why an agile and adaptable education system is so essential. So I should read the whole sentence, actually. Nobody can predict what some of the specific jobs of the future will look like. That is why an agile and adaptable education system is so essential for driving future productivity gains. I find this also quite an interesting statement, because our education system, if we are to, as this report is also saying, using best practice that we can distribute commonly amongst schools, how does that work with having an agile and adaptable education system that is innovative? Not necessarily sure how those things can all sort of link. So we've got these, we've got these different ideologies all sort of coming together in this media release. And in a way, they seem to kind of conflict with each other. And that's one of the big things that I like to investigate when I'm talking about ideologies in education, is seeing how they conflict with one another. And they kind of negate each other's sort of values. And so it was really interesting reading through this media release and seeing that come to light a little bit. Anyway, those are my thoughts. And look, it's a very brief, short review, and I haven't read through the whole document yet. So as I go through, I'm sure I'll get a more nuanced perspective of this. But if you're listening to this and you haven't even heard of the 5-Year Productivity Inquiry Interim Report, look it up, check it out, and please get involved by sending through a review. If you don't feel up to creating a long review and sending through evidence to support your arguments in relation to this inquiry, then just send through some short general comments. You can do that as well. I think it's really important that as teachers we understand that these are the sorts of things that are going to impact on our practice. And so if we can speak up now, maybe, just maybe, we can change them. Anyway, those are my short thoughts for this episode. So until next time, take care.
And that was Tom Marney with Ideology in Education. You can find him on Twitter at TomMarneyEDU, or again, look for the link to his profile in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. I will also make sure there are links to the Productivity Commission website and to the report that has been published. If you are not familiar with the Productivity Commission, you know, it's interesting to hear Tom's ideas and insights into the ideological manifestations in just a simple press release about what language kind of suggests certain ideological framings. But it's also worth looking at the overall ideological framing of this particular government body itself. I did make a few comments about this on Twitter at the time it was published, but this particular report, and if you're on any kind of social media in an education space, you surely saw some debate about this report, was full of a lot of suggestions for ways to improve costs in education. And one of the ones that particularly caused a bit of a reaction was it advocated in favor of independent public schools or a charter school model like they have in the US, or free schools like they have in the UK. And if you're not familiar with those kind of school models, they are basically publicly funded schools. They get the same quotient of public funding as any other government school does, but they are not bound by, well, depending on the model that you follow, they're bound either not by the curriculum requirements of the system, but more often than not, what they're primarily free of or not bound by are the industrial obligations of the system. So they can hire and fire teachers much more freely. And it's a model that, you know, ultimately it tries to disrupt the kind of permanency and stability of a teaching workforce. And it has led to, you know, charter schools have been active in the US for a long time. And I remember seeing a documentary about charter schools in the US called Backpack Full of Cash and talking to the filmmakers. And, you know, it has led to absurdities of schools advertising and promoting the fact that they fired 50% of their teachers at the end of 1 year, making it seem like they were being really hard on underperforming teachers, perhaps not aware of the fact that what it actually said was that their leadership was not very good at either hiring, onboarding, supporting, or training and facilitating the development of teachers. So that's the kind of model, and that's the kind of, you know, economic rationalist thinking that the report advocates for. But as I said on Twitter, the Productivity Commission is itself a fairly ideologically bound arm of government. It was created in the late 90s by John Howard's government, who were one of the most anti-public service, productivity and spending kind of that ideology, that neoliberal ideology or economic rationalist ideology that it was called here in Australia, really drove what they did. And the whole body exists not to actually solve problems in society, but to look at ways to achieve improvements in productivity in public spending. And improvements in productivity is usually policy speak for find ways to cut costs or to demand higher output for the same cost. So it's a body whose very purpose is already bound up in a particular ideology, that of cost savings and of a certain model of productivity. And this particular report was commissioned by the former government, by the coalition government, who themselves drove a huge deregulation agenda and cost-cutting agenda. Across the country, you've probably, if you've been to a GP lately, more than likely you've noticed that, for example, most doctors in Australia have stopped bulk billing, or at least a significant percentage of them, because the previous government made such significant cuts, or at least restricted spending growth of Medicare rebates. That's just one example of a cost-cutting policy where the question of, is it actually a long-term beneficial thing for the Australian population, is not a decision that's being made. It's simply, how do we minimise the cost spending, or how do we get higher output for less money being put in? Without questions being asked like, will this affect long-term health outcomes of particularly poor and vulnerable people who might now no longer have as easy access to a GP because they can't afford the upfront payments? And it's the same thing with this education report and with the Productivity Commission. The question that was put to them by the former coalition treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, was basically, how can we get better output from educational schools for reduced cost, or how can we get better educational output without increasing costs? So, for example, one thing in the report that got quite a bit of commentary was the fact that the report acknowledges that Australia has an imbalanced funding model for education, but then doesn't offer any commentary about it. And my point to that is that the Productivity Commission nor the terms of reference of that report were ever given the scope to comment on education funding, because the Commission and that report don't exist to actually solve problems. They exist to solve one particular problem from one particular perspective, and that is the problem of, quote unquote, public funding. Because there are, let's face it, an element in our politics and in our society that view public spending as a problem to be eliminated. So that report is sure to be generating debate for some time to come. The really interesting thing will be, what does the current government actually do with that report? What does the current government take from it and implement, if anything? Do they challenge any of the findings, or do they just bury it and move on with their own agenda? These are the kind of questions in politics that can only be answered by watching things play out over a long period of time. And that's certainly what we intend to do here at the TER podcast. But it is an indication of just how normalized the ideology of cost savings or cost benefit has dominated our discussion on public policy, where the people saying, but hang on, what about solving actual problems, are then positioned as the outsiders looking in and complaining. So, as I said before, I will post links to those reports, to the Productivity Commission website, for you to have a look at if you're not familiar with it. But it will surely be an influencing factor, or at least a shadow hanging over any future educational discourse, until such time as it is either addressed by the Federal Education Minister, which to my knowledge has not addressed it yet, or policies are announced and begun to be implemented that clearly either contradict or enact some of the findings in that report. That being said, it's time to move on to an irregular feature, shall we say, a fun feature. Something I like to do in this podcast is often to meet and speak to other Australian education podcasters, one, to help bring you an insight into what else is out there if you're not already familiar with it, and also to get an insight into how other people go about their podcasting process. And for this episode, I've got a bit of an extended segment talking to Dr. Phil Cummins and Adriano Di Prato. They are the hosts of the Game Changers podcast, and also collaborate on A School for Tomorrow, which is a kind of a consulting and advisory practice that they have, looking at delivering services and professional learning to schools. Game Changers is a relatively new podcast. It's been around for a couple of years, and in a short period of time has put out a huge volume of content. They have a different model, a different approach. They do it in series and tend to dump a whole series of episodes at once. And in a little under 3 years have put out nearly 200 episodes. This feature, this interview goes for a bit longer than these segments normally do. And once you hear the two of them start talking, you'll see just the banter, the dynamic that exists between them and how much fun it is just to listen to them talk. But in this, we have a chat about what is a school for tomorrow, what is their driving purpose in the work that they do, but then also what motivates Game Changers, the podcast, and what you can expect if you choose to listen to some of their content. So here now is Adriano De Prato and Dr. Phil Cummins discussing the Game Changers podcast. So joining me now are Adriano De Prato and Phil Cummins from A School for Tomorrow and the Game Changers podcast. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you, Cameron.
Hi, Cameron.
Well, let's start with A School for Tomorrow. The two of you are partners in this venture. What is A School for Tomorrow? What are you trying to achieve?
School for Tomorrow is a global network that unites students and teachers and leaders and teams in schools all over the world to help all of the members of their communities of inquiry and practice to thrive in their world. It arose out of the decade or so of work of the Circle Group in researching an education for character and the character of an excellent education. So we began that work in about 2010, and that followed on from 25 years of work that had been done by Creative School Management looking at what makes up a really, really good school. So that, you know, there's a good 40 years worth of thinking that's gone into what it is that we do. What we want to be able to do is to make it available to as many people around the world so that there's good evidence-based, research-driven understanding about what a great school is and how it might unlock the possibility of every individual, because, Adriano,
everyone is home to a unique life. And I suppose, Cameron, when you ask that question, that's ultimately the goal here. It is about us understanding in education and society how we can continue to empower all the people within our community. And I'm not just talking about our young people, I'm talking about the adults that support them as well. And having a deep consciousness about their uniqueness. In 2020, when the pandemic hit, it was really apparent to Phil and I that although the world was in a crisis that they probably hadn't felt or experienced at such a scale, and education, it was really impacted upon most profoundly, particularly in a state like Victoria. And what we recognised really quickly is that people were scrambling for support and for ways to do one of two things, either manage a response or lead through crisis. And what we did was, very early on, we put together a number of toolkits. They weren't revolutionary in their content necessarily, but they were centered around this notion that everyone is unique and everyone's home to a life. And because we operated from that construct, we created a toolkit around people and practice. We created a toolkit that centered around leading through crisis. And then we created a toolkit around heroing wellness at the center of what we do through Wellness by Design. What we found was there was a huge appetite. There was a huge appetite from an audience who, not only leaders, but your practitioners, parents, students, young people who were looking for ways through the fog because so many people were languishing. And what was clear to us was that our role at A School for Tomorrow then has to be around, yes, we are operating through the advantage of what research tells us, this evidence-based approach. There's real opportunity to be born from that because there's paths that have come before us that really help us clarify where we need to perhaps even go going forward. But what it also enables us to do is really build strong relationships with the communities that we support. And what are their pain points? What are the areas where they are doing exceptionally well, but what are the areas that they are struggling with to even just create a bridge to this better normal or next practice? Because it's confusing and it's confronting. And I feel that's our strength. You know, our strength is to go in there and support these people to see their inherent possibility and realize that they've got a lot of gifts and talents already within their communities. But how do we help them elevate what's sacred and also even better if.
And can I just ask, how did the two of you come to work together in this venture?
I was accosted in the streets of North Fitzroy.
Look, it's we've known each other for over a decade now. Adriano is the most connected man in Australian education, and really prides himself on building a network, a personal professional network around himself. He's a great thinker. He's got an enormous heart. And a great sense of what an education for the other might be. And I'd admired his work for years in this respect. We connected after a conference in 2017 and thought might be a good idea to do a bit of a project together. Adriana was at a school at that point in time. We started work on that project together. He decided to step out of the school he was in, and then I kept harassing him and saying, come on, we've got to do something together, do something together. Yes, we met at a bar in Fitzroy, had a very nice glass of organic red wine and talked about the possibility of doing a podcast. And right from the outset, we agreed that it wasn't going to be about ourselves because nobody's interested in an old art teacher and an even older history teacher. I call him an art teacher. He's really a design teacher, but it's more fun just to poke him rather than just to soothe him. It was all built on this understanding that what people need is a model. As in the relationships of learning that we would call character apprenticeship, it's our role as leaders within that is to model and to coach and to scaffold for others the adaptive expertise and the self-efficacy that they need for them to flourish, to thrive. And they need the opportunity to articulate what they're learning, to reflect on it, and then to explore further in and around that. What that means practically is, as with yourself, Cameron, you want to hold up examples of people who are doing the work already so that people can model on that, scaffold on it, and then go and iterate away into their own space around that. So that's where the Game Changers podcast sort of came from. We jumped into it straight away. I think we kind of wrote ourselves a little brief for the first one, and then we just kept doing it since then. You know what it's like. It's compulsive stuff.
It can be a little bit, yeah.
But we've also built it around the knowledge architecture of a school for tomorrow. So we've consciously chosen to work on the things we think that are important for us, such as the new social contract for education, which is today's learning for tomorrow's world, the four big competencies that we talk about, which are learn, live, lead and work. We talk about character and what it means to live a life that's well lived and worthwhile. All of our series have been sort of themed in that way around those central concepts around that. And then we just invite really interesting people. I say we. Adriano does most of the sort of thinking about what it is we're going to do and how we're going to do it. I'm not really sure what I do. I think I just turn up.
It's underselling it. When we first met, probably even before 2017, but that's when we started working together on that particular project, what I discovered really quickly, Cameron, was here was an individual who I had seen from a distance or even had conversations with, but I never really understood that his depth of commitment to the value of the research that's required to really shape and form and inform really effective practice. And also the research that demonstrates an audit of where we're at any given time. And I think that's an important component. And so what I discovered very quickly was that depth. And working with Phil on that project in a school context where we were looking at the possibility of crafting a dynamic, emerging, established and senior leader program, very bespoke for all of them, all deeply aligned to AITSL's standards, particularly the principal standards. I was in a Catholic school at the time too, so there was a real synergy to the staff's faith journey as well. So I learned very quickly that Phil had a capacity to be very adaptive in those spaces, and I really admired that. I really admired that really quickly, because it's one thing when you're a professor and you are presenting your work, it's your research. You have poured hours on this, you know, based on whatever provocation that you've set for yourself. And it would be fair to say, well, that's what it is, yeah? But the strength of Dr. Phil Cummins is his capacity then to take that and to support communities in their context to realise their possibility based on that research. What? How does this work in your context? What do you see that's congruent? What's in conflict? Why is that? And I feel that we complement one another because we are two very different individuals in many ways. I mean, he supports a code that is totally irrelevant in NRL or whatever it is or something like that.
I think you'll find that's rugby union.
Oh, sorry. I forgot. The second world game.
I believe the term they use is barracks for a couple of clubs in a couple of codes, both of which seem to have blue as their colour and are completely irrelevant to anybody of any substance or worth in the world.
Yeah, I know. Chelsea's clearly irrelevant being Champions League winners. But anyway, we'll just keep moving on. But so I feel that what we do, Cameron, is that we can descend into that space of some gentle ribbing and banter, but we also have huge admiration for each other's capacity to continue to grow and evolve. And there's great complementarity there. You know, Phil goes into those weeds and really looks at the depth of that detail and tries to find the patterns, you know, that can really then speak to people. And then I look at the opportunities of, okay, how can we then communicate that in a way that's going to connect people to the power of this research?
I think one of the things I really enjoy about our relationship, you know, in theatre sports, there's the rule of no blocking.
Mm-hmm.
So that whenever something is offered up, you must take it and run with it. We've always done that with each other. We didn't. It's just been a modus operandi. At a professional level, it was never something that we discussed. It just happens automatically. And one of the things I really love is when I throw some really outrageous or stupid idea up into the air, Adriano will look at me really intensely. He'll then lean back, draw a deep breath, look away, and then take the idea and start playing with it and seeing where we can go with it and so on. And it's those moments. It's the same thing when we're having conversations. It's the same thing when we're doing things either live or in the podcast or so on. Sometimes there's a script, but, you know, most of the time it's way more fun when I take great delight in messing with Adriano's script, you know, because it's just That's in my nature to be just a little provocative on occasions like that. And then he will throw something straight back at me as well too. It's the Hegelian thing, you know. It's thesis, antithesis and synthesis at the end of it, isn't it? You know, there's got to be a little bit of a friction there, I think, because it gets you thinking. And out of that, it takes you out of what the big fella would talk about. You know, it takes you out of binary thinking into a space where you can genuinely create with each other, and you know, it's fun.
If we advocate through the vehicle of A School for Tomorrow or our podcast Game Changers about the inherent possibility of self, place and the other, and we don't do it with each other, well, then we're disingenuous. It's got to be part of it. It's not got to be part of it. It is part of our DNA.
Yeah. So when we talk about game changers, you mentioned you like to talk to people that are modelling practice, and obviously, I guess, a bit of banter is what people can expect. But what are you hoping that listeners will take away from engaging with your podcast content?
I think one of the things that has emerged from what we do on the podcast is that if you want people to give to you in a conversation, you have to be able to be prepared to give. So we don't look at any of our conversations as an interview. They're always a conversation. And you've got to be prepared to go into vulnerable spaces. You've got to be prepared to give of yourself and reveal things, and because that way you're going to get back from, I guess, not just the stuff that they're rehearsed and scripted and prepared and delivered many times before. You're going to get from them who they are. I mean, we teach who we are. We lead from the core of our being. We lead with who we are. So if that's the case, then we want a guest to show us who they are. We have to be prepared to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. I can remember there was a conversation I had with Tracy...
Hayley Watson,
there it is. I'm sorry. I'm a very old man and I forget words quite easily. Dr. Hayley Watson, who's a tremendous clinical psychologist from Canada who does great work in and around and out here. And we ended up, I don't know how it was, we ended up talking about bullying in schools, because you do, don't you? Because it's a perennial problem. It's a perennial human problem. It's something that can never be eradicated. It can be limited and it can be mitigated, but we're always going to deal with that worst side of human nature in a schooling context. And in the conversation, Hayley drew out of me, you know, my own experience of spending 4 years, years five through eight at the school I was at, of being bullied absolutely horribly. And it's just something I had never told anybody publicly ever in my life before. You know, so it's things like that that I can remember talking with Professor Alan Duffy and Adriano, asking him sorts of questions which weren't about the sort of prepared geeky things I think he was anticipating. But, you know, it was about asking about, you know, questions about why does antimatter matter and things like that. And then watching the cogs of this amazing mind of Alan Duffy moving in a direction and giving us insight into the epistemology and even the ontology of a great scientist and communicator, helping us to think about what being actually is. So less about the stuff and more about the purpose of why he's there, why he does what he does, and then how that leads into practice, which is, you know, which, and that's what we're interested in. And that's part of the thinking of a school for tomorrow. It's part of our research, you know, that if there's going to be something that makes a difference in the lives of our children, it's going to be because they've got a sense of purpose around what they do. So that's the ontology. That's of an educational process. We need to help as many kids connect with a sense of purpose. So we have to have the same. And that sense of purpose needs to be put into practice, but it needs to be informed by a deep awareness and appreciation of people and place and planet. So we look to the outside to drive what's inside, and that's that wrestling between the inner and the outer that makes the character of a life that's well lived and worthwhile.
You know, to complement what Phil has been sharing with us here, Cameron, when I reflect upon the mission of Game Changers, you know, we've got a nice little statement there about, you know, the brave pioneers, you know, who don't wait for permission but simply do something.
Yeah.
That's the what. That's what it is. But the reality is Game Changers is fundamentally about why and how. It's exactly what Phil just shared. It's the why is someone's purpose and the how is their practice. And at the heart of all of that, when I mention this phrase, you know, everyone's home to a unique life, that's at the core of Game Changers, because what we are basically doing is we're engaging in the remarkable, unique story of our guest. And some of them are 20 years old. Some are in their 70s. Some are people of colour. There's a range of diversity in terms of ethnicity. Of course, gender mix. Years of experience. Some are in education, predominantly education. Many are from industry. Many from business. Many from social enterprise. But if we're serious about believing that everyone in our communities is home to a unique life, then if we don't get to the core of who they are, what's their why, what drives them in their how, which is their practice, then we're just having a nice kind of small talk chat then, right? When we attempt consciously in every conversation, although we have well researched about our guests and we have lots of questions lined up, Phil's exactly right. What we then do is there are moments in those conversations, and I'm sure you have this with your guests as well, where they've let you in. They've opened the door, and we'll have a back channel going either on the text or something like that, and we'll go with it. Like, you know, go. I know I'm next, but you go. And we just delve into that, and we keep peeling it back. Some tries to stay on script, but then we're actually going, why don't you ask this? Because we're trying to get them to reveal more of that wrestling that has gotten them to this point of, what was that moment where you determined that was going to be your difference? And then when was that moment or moments where you were enlightened enough to realize that the practice that you're engaging with, it has value and brings values to others? Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I think on the episodes I've listened to, I think that notion of getting to the heart of a person's values and motivation is one of the things I always find most interesting in the discussions I've heard in your podcast as well. Just to ask a question about deciding to do a podcast, you mentioned that one thing you admired about Phil was he was quite adaptive. How have you adapted to the production process? Do either of you have a background in that kind of media production, or how have you fit that into your daily routine? Because I think I should be noted as well. One thing I think can be said about your podcast that is possibly unique in all of education Australian podcasting is the rate of knots at which you are generating content. You know, in less than 3 years, you've put out nearly 200 episodes. So how have you taken to the production side of things to be doing it, especially at the volume that you're doing it?
Okay, so the first thing I'll say on that is that I feel that our method of working is we will meet first and we will discern the theme for that particular series. And it's not just a heading. We will really kind of unpack the intentionality of what we're trying to ultimately achieve. And where is there a synergy with the work of A School for Tomorrow? Because we have to be congruent with what we believe and our aspirations
there. And we try really hard in that process to align what we think is going to happen in the conversations with our guests, because you can only predict it. And also then align that with the written content that we put out to our members every week. So we do a publication every Monday. It's called Monday Bites, which is a short summary of a piece of research. We do case studies of members and of significant leaders within our network. Once a quarter, we put out a research journal, which talks about the theme for the quarter as a whole. So we've got a very structured approach to the content that we want to put out, and the podcast is all part of that.
So once it's basically stepping into a place of deep listening and really understanding what it is that we're wanting to ultimately achieve there. So there's an empathy kind of component to that. It's a deep understanding. Once that's been established, then I go away and kind of define it a little bit by doing the research and curating a lineup that honours whose voices are missing around this diversity piece. For us, it's less about diversity, more about the deep sense of belonging and identity. And then I go about contacting these individuals and inviting them to be part of the show. Then I introduce them to our client liaison or our communications associate, who then books them, lines them up. I go away and curate a whole series of questions. Phil does a light edit on those, reorganises them for a synergy about a story.
We never share that with the guest in advance.
Yeah, never.
Because we don't want prepared answers.
Mm.
Yeah. And so then we do them, right? And when it comes to the tech production side of things, you're looking at two novices here, mate. So we've outsourced that initially to Phil's son, Oliver Cummins. So if he's listening to this, thank you, Oliver. And in most recent times, Lachlan. But I know that's going to continue to evolve as we look at to refine our associates within our organisation. And then there is a lot of the post-production stuff. When it comes to the marketing and the design elements, I'll take a handle of that type of stuff and get that moving along. I'm indebted to one of my former students who's responsible for the design of our brand, which we really love, the energy of it. And it's had lots of different iterations as a result, because you've got block colours, it's really easy to interchange. And that's pretty much the way it works.
We tend to focus on having content season, so there'll be times, we'll try and do all of our recordings for a series within about a three-week period, ideally around that. And when we do it, when we're recording, we try and make sure that that's the thing that we're doing on that day, so that the energy that we've got is focused on the guest, and that we can give them our full presence and try not worry about a meeting beforehand or a meeting afterwards or so on and so on. We both work very long days. We do that because that's our habit, and we like doing that, although he tends to work late into the night, which I don't do anymore because I just get tired. But I've usually got sort of 6 o'clock, 6:30 calls to New York or or the UK or Canada with part of our consulting clients as well too. So I tend to work the first shift in the day, and Adriano tends to work the second shift in the day.
In terms of the volume, I appreciate you illustrating to your audience the volume of shows that we've been able to produce in such a concentrated amount of time. Once we have discerned the approach or the theme and the intention of that, I'm like a dog with a bone, mate, and I just go and I'm on it straight away. And I'm one of those people that I become very restless until I feel it's complete. So there's a pace and velocity about hard. It, and there are times where Phil's even like, "Can we just slow down a little bit?"
I think one of the things too, which is really important, Cameron, is that we have absolute trust in both Oliver and Lachlan to do the production work, and so therefore, once it's recorded, we don't get involved at all in what goes out.
Right.
That's up to them to do that, which means that we can focus on the front end rather than the back end. Of it, we're very lucky. They're two very talented young men. One, despite his father, who can they do what they do with a very light and deft touch around what it is they do.
In fact, our intro music has been produced by your son.
Yeah, Ollie wrote the drums. Which is pretty good. I think too, if I can, the one of the benefits of having all of that content is it meant that when it came to writing a book, Hawker Brownlow Education were very keen for us to put out a book on what we'd learned about leadership from all of the various different things. It meant that we've got 130 different voices that we can draw from the 11 series that we've done so far. And include that thinking and the contributions and understanding and wisdom of those people within the book itself as well too, which is, that's a pretty good thing, Thank you for the chance to plug the book. I appreciate that, Cameron.
You're welcome. Well, look, the podcast is Game Changers, as you say, from your work with the School for Tomorrow. I'll make sure that there are links for people who may not have yet had a chance to listen, and I highly encourage them to do so. But Adriano, Phil, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Cameron.
Thank you very much.
And that was Adriano Di Prato and Dr. Phil Cummins talking about the Game Changers podcast. You can find a link to their profiles and to their podcast in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com, or I'm sure you can find it by simply searching Game Changers Podcast. I'm going to take a short break now, and when I return, it will be with this episode's main feature, an interview with Stephanie Westcott discussing her PhD thesis into teaching in a post-truth era and the hegemonic nature of the what works discourse in education.
The Teachers Education Review is produced by teachers for teachers, exploring ideas to help improve teaching practices around Australia and around the world. If you like the TER podcast, you can help us to promote and improve the show. If you have an idea for a feature segment, a strategy you'd like to share as part of the Teachers Brains Trust, or if you would like to leave comments or feedback on one of our episodes, then please visit our website at terpodcast.com. where you will find information on ways to contribute to the show. To help promote the show, leave us a rating and a review through iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, or whichever portal you use to subscribe to the show. Share your favourite episodes with colleagues, other educators that you know, or with anyone who has an interest in learning more about education. Finally, if you are organising an educational event and would like it to be considered for a feature on the Teachers Education Review, then contact us via email at info@terpodcast.com. Thank you for supporting the Teachers Education Review. Now please enjoy this episode's main feature.
Stephanie Westcott is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Melbourne and former English teacher. Recently, she completed her PhD on teaching in a post-truth era and looking at the hegemonic nature of the what works discourse in education. In this interview, I discuss with Stephanie her PhD research and really try to understand what it means to be teaching in a post-truth era, and also what it means for teachers to be subject to a hegemonic power structure in education. So here now
is Stephanie Westcott discussing teaching in a post-truth era. I'm joined now by Stephanie Westcott. Stephanie, thank you for your time.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.
So we're here to talk about your recently submitted PhD thesis with the title Education, Policy and Practice in the Post-Truth Era. And before I read the whole title, I just want to, settle a debate here. Hegemony or hegemony?
Ooh, this is a really contested term. I say hegemony, but I know some people say hegemony, and I believe that either is fine.
All right, because the second half of the title is Interrogating the Evidence-Based Hegemony. Yes. So we'll go with that pronunciation for tonight. Yes. Now, in straightforward terms, what was it you were setting out to investigate with this research?
So basically, I was looking at post-truth, and I was like, okay, this is interesting. It's bothering me a lot. Stuff's happening. Stuff's changing. What does it have to do with education policy? That's what I set out to understand, if there was a relationship between the two things, specifically education policy in Victoria, because that's where I was teaching at the time.
And just to clarify, particularly in academic terms, what do we mean when we say post-truth?
So post-truth is a term that describes sort of social, political condition that we live in at the moment. It sort of indicates a changed relationship to what truth means, who gets to tell the truth, and how we tell it. So it's often attributed to the rise of people like Donald Trump, who play with the truth, who create their own version of truth. It's also attributed to some of the vaccine vaccine misinformation. So it's the idea that the time that we're living in at the moment, we are not so concerned with what the truth is. We're more concerned with the story that we want to tell to elicit a particular emotional response.
And so in a field like education, where I imagine most teachers would like to believe some notion of truth is fairly central to the things that they teach, It sounds like a concept that can have quite far-reaching implications for education and teaching. But just to clarify one thing, how do you differentiate, how does being in a post-truth era differentiate from just saying, well, that person's lying? Like, how does it become a movement? How does it go from that person's lying or that person's full of it to we live in a post-truth era?
I think what makes the distinction is that it's whether the truth matters anymore. So when you talk about truth as opposed to talking about a lie, there's a very clear understanding there that one matters and one is, when of course lies matter, but we think the truth matters more. Whereas in post-truth, the question sort of is, well, does truth matter? Who gets to decide?
Is there a direct relationship? I mean, you mentioned Donald Trump as an example, and for a period of time he occupied one of, if not the most powerful political offices in the world. Is there a direct relationship to power and the abandonment of truth as a value?
I think so, because when I've said a couple of times in this interview, like, who gets to decide what the truth is? Well, that's power. And one of the terms in my title, hegemony, this is an idea that comes from Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian socialist who wrote a bunch of diaries when he was imprisoned. And the idea of hegemony is that ideas don't just, ideas that are culturally embedded or culturally accepted don't just emerge out of thin air. They are manufactured and they are constructed by usually or typically people who hold positions of power in society. So they're the ones who get to decide what the truth is, and then that sort of trickled down, below them to the other classes.
Does that suggest that this notion of post-truth in policy or politics or government or any operation of power is more of a deliberate act?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think so. I think politics has always used obfuscation in order to you know, meet particular ends. And I think this is a particular manifestation of that kind of playfulness. And I don't mean that in a fun way, but playfulness with ideas and reality and truth. So, yeah, absolutely.
And so, as you say, that the phrase in the title is the evidence-based hegemony.
Yes.
Where do you position the notion of evidence-based, whether it's evidence-based practice, evidence-based policy, in relation to this notion of the post-truth?
Yeah. So this is a question that I grappled with throughout my PhD over the 3.5 years it took me to do it. I was thinking, what is the relationship? Is there one at all? And I was completely prepared to decide at the end of my thesis that there was no relationship between the two things at all. But in the end, I decided that there were three key ways that post-truth and contemporary policy have a relationship to one another. The first is that what we're seeing, not only in Australia, but in the UK and the US as well, is this idea that evidence-based practice equals absolute truth. This notion that if a practice in teaching is evidence-based, it cannot be refuted. It cannot be questioned because it's evidence-based. And it doesn't matter where that evidence necessarily came from, what kind of methodologies produce that evidence, whether they are reliable or not. The idea that if something is evidence-based, it's absolute, is pretty widespread in teaching at the moment. So I've argued that that's a post-truthy sort of thing, this absolutism of evidence as a truth. The other way that I've argued that they're interacting with one another is the sort of certainty and absolutism that we're seeing in practice at the moment and in discourse around practice. I think certainly when I was a teacher and my participants have observed similar things, there's it's very hard to have a nuanced conversation in education at the moment about practice. You sort of are ideologically positioned one way or another. And that is also a post-truth sort of thing. The other sort of interesting thing I think about post-truth and policy at the moment is, whereas in the sort of political and social realm, there's been a sort of decreased burden of proof required when making a truth claim. Like, for example, let's talk about Donald Trump again. He could really say whatever he wanted and claim it as a truth. We saw Scott Morrison do similar things as well. That is a very post-truth thing, the idea that you can just make a claim, you don't necessarily require proof or evidence. Paradoxically, what's happening in education at the moment with teachers is that the burden of proof has actually increased. So when teachers want to make a claim about teaching, about their practice, about their students' learning, they are required to support that with a particular type of data, or connected to an evidence-based practice, for example. So that's an interesting paradox.
So if teachers are being subject to greater demands for evidence for their truth claims, particularly, is that particularly or just limited to when it comes to practice or just in general?
I think it's in general, yeah.
So if teachers are then subject to this increased demand for evidence to support those truth claims,
mm-hmm.
what does that position teachers somewhere particularly within the power dynamic? Like, is that a symptom of them being of lower power than other people in authority?
Yeah, I think teachers are positioned interestingly in relation to policy at the moment, because what is another consequence of evidence-based policy is that the expertise is developed and produced elsewhere outside of the classroom. So the evidence is collected, manufactured, delivered, and then, you know, teachers are sort of presented with, well, here are evidence-based practices that you should be using in your classroom. An example, if you're a Victorian teacher, you'd be familiar with things like high-impact teaching strategies that are developed by the department through evidence collected through a number of different researchers. So I think that it's sort of fair to say, to an extent, teachers are subject to these burdens of proof. And another example of that is the use of particular types of data that are sort of enforceable for teachers to use. So I'm talking particularly about quantitative data, such as the idea that you should be, you know, referring to externally collected modes of data like NAPLAN data, for example, when you want to make an inference about student learning rather than the notion that a teacher can make an assessment themselves in their classroom using their expertise.
So just let me summarise to make sure I've got all that clear in my head. Mm-hmm. What we're describing in this with this combination of recognising education in a post-truth era and the evidence-based hegemony is the idea that people in power can make claims that are taken as true with fewer demands on of evidence from those people in power, while people who have less power, who in this case are teachers, are subject to increasing demands for evidence in support of their claims, and their personal judgment or their professional judgment and expertise is less trusted as a source of evidence.
Yes.
So the scales are really tipped in favour of power to create a narrative, whether it's connected to reality or not.
That's a pretty good summation. Yeah. And I think when we're talking about evidence-based practice as well, when we're looking, I don't know if you teach, do you teach in Victoria? Are you Victorian-based or?
New South Wales.
New South Wales.
We've got CC.
Yeah, okay. So the sort of current or contemporary policy framework in Victoria is a Victorian teaching and learning model. And this is developed from evidence collected by a really small number of researchers. Scott Ecott would probably refer to them as gurus. And so what we're seeing in – that's another example of sort of how – I'm not necessarily saying that the researchers who have developed this or the gurus have a lesser burden of proof. You know, they've conducted their work in an academic way. But it is about, I think, a collection of powerful names who have produced this, or their work has been drawn on to produce this particular policy, and teachers are then subject to that network of power and their ideas around what good teaching looks like.
But you mentioned before that the construction of these narratives in a post-truth era might have a deliberate action or a deliberate intent behind it.
Mm-hmm.
In your research, did you identify any motivating factors behind the creation of this circumstance?
Well, it's sort of been written about before about why are we so seduced by evidence-based practice? Why do educational policymakers like this idea that evidence can be like a, I mean, that education can be like a science, or that education can be practiced like medicine, or educational research can be like medicine. And the notion is that education is seen as sort of a messy space where we don't really have a clear set of understandings about why things are the way they are and what we should do and why, and therefore evidence can impose order and structure and clarity into the space. So I haven't necessarily come to that same conclusion myself in my thesis, but I think it's a pretty good argument. And I do think that there is an idea that if we can make education practice and policy more scientific, if we can begin to do more research that, like randomized controlled trials, like we do in medical research, then we will improve educational outcomes for students. So I think that's the general motivation.
Just drawing on a train of thought that comes to mind at this point, did you identify or did you look at the relationship between the policy desire to make everything sort of measurable and quantifiable and the policy desire to also make everything accountable? I don't know if you know Tom Marney, who does a segment on this podcast about ideology and education. He talks a bit about the social efficiency ideology and the idea that, the idea driving some policy that everything must be able to be accounted for and every dollar spent must be able to produce a measurable outcome. Mm. And it seems that a natural parallel to that is a drive to make everything quantifiable and measurable, even if maybe it's not as measurable as we would want it to be or people might want it to be.
Yeah, I think I didn't specifically look at accountability, but it is certainly a part of what has created the contemporary policy conditions, particularly around, you know, we've been writing and talking about neoliberalism in education for a long time, and accountability is a significant aspect of that. But what teachers in my study did say was that they, the type of accountability that they are subject to at the moment is around how they use particular parts of policy, and whether they use them at all. So, for example, there are particular parts of the policy such as it recommends the use of learning intentions and success criteria. It says that these things are, you know, particularly effective. And what's happening in some schools is that leadership are requiring that teachers have these things visible in their classroom all the time. So a leader, a school leader, a principal should be able to walk past the classroom, see a teacher's learning intention and, you know, success criteria visible in the classroom at all times. And that's a form of accountability that is sort of adjacent to the policy suite in Victoria at the moment.
I mean, we've already, I feel like we've delved into some of the details, but keeping all that in mind, how would you actually describe then the current state of educational policy within the scope of what you looked at your research? I mean, it sounds like a potentially dire circumstance where people in power are making claims and setting narratives and policy agendas without being accountable to the truth of their claims.
Yeah, I think, let me think about that for a minute. I think when we're talking about policymaker accountability here, I don't think it's the same as teacher accountability, because I think these policies are designed and built with good intentions. It's not that people are, you know, cynical, or that people are trying to necessarily design things, you know, in sort of, I don't know, just there's no a sort of evil attached here. It's more the way that I think the problem is when we say that there is one way to do things and that way is absolute and it's proven, and a teacher with their, you know, with their expertise and their knowledge and their years of practice, you know, if they're not able to contest that, I think that's a problem. But I do think these policies are designed to do good things in schools, but I just think some of the rhetoric around them, some of the discourse and the ways that they are being implemented are where the problems are.
What sort of examples did you look at in your research?
So what I did in my research was I did a discourse analysis of the policy, and then I interviewed practicing teachers who are working in Victoria at the moment, and then I also looked at sort of organisations that I refer to as policy intermediaries, so groups that are doing the work of disseminating policy in a number of different ways. And what I found from my work with teachers is that they have some concerns about the way that the contemporary policy initiatives are being enacted in their schools. They have concerns about the nature of these particular policies, certainly around the absolutism of these policies and the inability of them, of teachers, to challenge them and say, well, hold on a minute, I don't know if I agree with this and I don't know if it is appropriate for my students. And then the retort is, well, it's evidence-based. There's an evidence base here, so sort of don't have a position here. So those were sort of the main themes that came out of my conversations with teachers that are sort of post-truthy, because we're playing here with who can tell the truth, who can question ideas, and who gets to sort of, yeah, design what truth means in a particular context.
And how far did you get to actually answering those questions?
I mean, it's complex and it's nuanced, and it's something that I grappled with. And I think I only got clear in the last few months of my PhD what this relationship actually is between post-truth and contemporary policy. But it sort of ultimately comes back to the sort of three key ideas that I spoke about before, that you know, if we say something in education is evidence-based, well, does that mean it's an absolute truth, or can teachers challenge it? Can they undermine the power, its power and authority? You know, the second thing is the certainty and absolutism in practice and the increased burden of proof. So they're kind of the key things that I keep coming back to.
And you mentioned before, when I asked about the situation of people in power sort of not having the same accountability for truth claims, your comment that there's no evil behind it, I'm not necessarily suggesting that there's evil behind it, but it sounds like a culture being created where, I mean, what this connects to in my head, sorry, I'm going to take another sidestep here.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, the media narrative about teaching is that there is a teaching crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And that one of the things driving the number of teachers leaving the profession or people choosing not to become part of the teaching profession is status, is treatment within the profession. And it sounds to me like what you're describing is the effects of this culture or this impact of post-truth on policy and educational practice is very much a disempowerment of the teacher to both be trusted to make informed decisions and to question decisions that are made, which seem very much to me to align to that notion of the deprofessionalizing of teachers.
Yeah, absolutely. That came through very clearly in my research, that teachers really are feeling quite undermined by policy at the moment, and the way that it's enacted in their schools, and that they feel that they don't necessarily have something that came up as well is sort of this idea is that if you're challenging evidence-based policy, are you then anti-science or are you anti-research? Like, what is your positioning if you're challenging evidence-based policy? And it's very hard for a teacher to occupy that kind of space because as teachers, we're intellectuals, we read research, we are university educated. It's challenging because in the sort of cultural and social sphere, if you challenge evidence or research, you probably suffer from post-truth conditions and symptoms. You might, you know, be an anti-vaxxer, for example. But I think something that I have written about in my research is that, you know, if a teacher with their expertise and their knowledge challenges an evidence-based claim, or an evidence-based practice, that's completely legitimate and completely warranted, and we should be encouraged to have that open discourse in a really democratic way about practice. That was a sort of tricky thing to try and read through and write through. How do we position ourselves as teachers when we are saying we don't agree with something that's evidence-based? Because we work with evidence and we work with knowledge in this way.
Well, sometimes I think it's not even just challenging claims or questioning claims. Sometimes it's even, you know, I've observed this even on just in social media discourse and in the workplace. But even when someone sort of says, I want to fully understand this before I'm expected to implement it, even that can be treated as, no, just sort of do what you're told. This is evidence-based. We're telling you what to do. But then how can you expect someone to enact a practice they don't fully understand?
Mm.
So, you know, just another manifestation of that. And I suppose that leads to another question. Is the notion of post-truth, especially when applied to policy and given that education is inherently a political construction, we're talking about politics and government here. Is post-truth inherently an authoritarian manifestation? Because it does sound a little bit to me like it's people in power saying, do what I say, whether it's true or not.
Mm. I think, I haven't thought about post-truth and authoritarianism, but there is some recent writing on the erosion of democracy. Wendy Brown published a really great book in the last few years called Undoing the Demos. And I think we are seeing in a number of democracies around the world, the, you know, this erosion of of our principles of democracy that we've held really tightly for a long time. So I do think that there is a connection between changing what the truth is or insisting on particular ideas as truth and authoritarianism. I think that's absolutely true because we live in a society where the truth matters and truth is innately connected to trust. So, yeah, I absolutely do think there's a connection there, and I think it's important to consider in educational policy making and in practice, especially when we're talking about teachers' claims to expertise and agency, who gets to say what the truth is when we're talking about a classroom and a teacher's practice.
And so at the end of this process, you know, you've been studying this for 3.5 years, as you said, you've done many interviews and analysis of policy documents. What do you see as the implications of this for educational policy going forward, but also for teacher practice on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky time to be a teacher because teachers are increasingly under pressure to be and incorporate evidence-based practice in their work, to work with quantitative data, the profession is increasingly, I think, technocratic. I think what I've sort of concluded with in my thesis is a sort of suggestion that we should engage in these conversations in schools, that rather than the imposition of policy or the imposition of evidence-based rhetoric in schools, which is certainly what we're seeing, this is what my participants are suggesting, that there should be an ability for teachers to contest, to challenge, to undermine where necessary, and to see educational conversations as expressions of democratic thinking and an appreciation for democratic thinking as well. What I'm thinking though is like, where is the time for that to happen? When can teachers have the opportunity to engage in thoughtful critique? It's, you know, when I was teaching and thinking about these issues before I began my PhD, these sort of things were introduced to us, you know, 4 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, you know, when you've had a full day of teaching and you're thinking about getting home and whatever else. But I think teachers certainly are part of, I mean, teachers who are on Twitter, for example, are really engaged with these conversations. Teachers who are participants in research, such as mine, are engaged in these conversations too. And these, this dialogue is certainly happening in schools and among teachers. So the implications of my research is an encouragement to teachers to continue to be critical, to insist on the importance and the centering of their expertise and their perspectives in decision making and in conversations about what constitutes truth in practice.
But then what avenues do teachers have for engaging in that discourse if, as you say, the sort of one of the manifestations of this is to try and shut down or, you know, silence dissenting voices?
There are a couple
Or is that a question for a different interview?
Well, look, I don't have an answer because a couple of my participants gave specific examples of instances where they had tried to approach leadership in their schools and say, look, I'm not sure about this. This doesn't sit well with me. And they were shut down. You know, the response was, well, this is right. This is evidence. This is what's happening, and there was really no recourse for them. So, look, I don't have a solution. I don't have an answer to that, unfortunately. And that's, you know, perhaps an avenue for future research and writing.
So, Stephanie, it's a fascinating topic, and it sounds like one that we could probably continue to unpack. You know, I mean, when you talk about post-truth, I think about the American comedian Stephen Colbert, who long before we were even talking about post-truth had the word truthiness recognized as a word of the year. He used to talk about people saying things that felt true even if they weren't. And then, you know, he said that nearly 10 years before Donald Trump became the president, given that we've talked about him as an example.
Yes.
And I suppose the one final question, I don't know if this has come up in your research at all, but something that is definitely relevant in the realm of politics where more attention has been paid to this issue of the post-truth era is in politics, it seems to be particularly a manifestation of tribalism in a sense, in this, you know, people are willing to abandon truth in order to stay part of their tribe. And you mentioned things being incredibly divisive in education. Are we seeing that same kind of tribalism override truth in education, or is there something else going on?
I think we are absolutely seeing that. I think things are very divisive. I think conversations are succumbing to quite binary thinking. And that's absolutely a problem. I think it's a replication of political conditions. And sort of, as I said before in my previous answer, there needs to be more space for nuance, for contradiction, for paradox, because that's what teaching is. It's absolutely not black and white, one way or the other, absolutely this, absolutely that. It changes from minute to minute. So, yeah, absolutely.
So for anybody who'd like to learn more about some of these topics, particularly their application to education, where would you recommend they start reading?
So there's a lot of writing on post-truth and education, what it means for practice. So, you know, a search for post-truth and education will bring up a lot of writing on that topic. I've got a couple of papers in the works. So, you know, I'm on Twitter and I've got a Google Scholar profile, and, you know, my contact details are available. So if any listeners would like to read more, I'm happy to send out any publications that anyone would like to read.
All right. Well, I'll make sure there's a link to that profile in the show notes for this episode. Stephanie, thank you for this conversation and best of luck with your future publications.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Stephanie Westcott discussing teaching in a post-truth era. You can find links to her profile, particularly her Google Scholar profile, in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. And if you haven't already done so, I'd like to make a special request. Please consider going to patreon.com/TER podcast and please consider signing up as a regular supporting patron of this show. You can join for as little as $3 a month or about $1.50 an episode, and any contributions are greatly appreciated towards the ongoing costs of both recording and running the podcast, as well as any equipment or services that need to be procured along the way. This podcast has always been a non-commercial practice. We've never accepted advertising or sponsorship of any kind. Everything we do has been of free choice of myself and the other producers of the show along the way. But the costs do keep increasing. And if you appreciate the work that we do, we would appreciate your support in the form of some sort of small recurring financial contribution. There are four levels of sponsorship you can sign up for, and they come with various perks along the way. But always this podcast has been free for the education community and will always be free for the education community. So if you appreciate that work that we do, please consider going to patreon.com/TER podcast and signing up. You know, when I started this podcast with Corinne Campbell nearly 9.5 years ago, I was working variously as a head teacher or a deputy principal level role with no children, living in an outer suburban area of Sydney. And now, 9.5 years later, I'm a classroom teacher with nearly 3 children. In fact, it's entirely possible by the time the next episode goes online, number 3 might be here. And, of course, I'm living in the inner west of Sydney. So very, very different financial contexts as well. that this podcast has been getting produced under. So yes, again, please, if you are in a position to help, we would appreciate any contribution or support of our ongoing work, again, at patreon.com/TER podcast. That does bring us to the end of this episode. However, in the coming weeks and months between now and Christmas, we have a couple of special episodes that'll be getting released coming out of the ACEL National Conference. There'll be an episode providing a bit of an overview of that conference and some insight into the content and the speakers that were on offer there. And also a special episode looking at a project ACEL have been doing in conjunction with the Australian Learning Lecture, looking at schools that are really trying to do things differently in order to set students up for the future as we anticipate it may be. So some very interesting content there coming to you courtesy of also the ACEL, the Australian Council for Educational Leaders, and their 2022 National Conference. So don't miss those when you see them in your podcast feed. Otherwise, I'll see you in a fortnight's time. And until then, this has been the Teachers Education Review.
Thank you for listening to the Teachers Education Review. All opinions expressed in this episode are those of the individual speakers only and do not represent the views of their employers or any other affiliated organisations. For links, show notes, and information on how you can contribute to the Teachers Education Review, be sure to visit terpodcast.com.
This podcast is part of the Australian Educators Online Network. AEON.net.au